Case for argument this morning is 20-2061, Taha v. United States. Ms. Rollins, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you're free to remove your mask or not at your...
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Kara Rollins, on behalf of taxpayers Mr. Ali Taha, the estate of Mr. Muhammad E. Taha, deceased, and Ms. Sana M. Yasin. The principal issue before the Court is whether Mr. Taha has properly invoked the Court's jurisdiction. There's two aspects to the jurisdiction that come into play. First is whether or not the tax refund claim was filed. That answer directly turns on whether or not the common law mailbox rule has survived the adoption of Section 7502. There's a circuit split that has developed over time suggesting it hasn't. It is an open question in this court whether or not the silence of that statute as to a never-delivered tax refund claim permits the common law mailbox rule to essentially fill in the
silence. You say the silence of the statute with regards to never-delivered tax claim, but it actually speaks to certain instances where a never-delivered claim can still qualify, right? If it's sent by registered or certified mail.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not silent on never delivered. It just has a limitation on never delivered.
Your Honor, what we look at when we look at 7502 is that 7502A is a general rule regarding how do we deem the postmark of a refund claim that was delivered. And that applies to all types of U.S. mails. Then there's a special exception that comes into play that Congress has created a carve-out for registered and certified mail. However, in reading the statute and looking at the legislative history of the statute, there's no reason to believe that the common law mailbox rule, which the Supreme Court in Rosenthal deemed well settled in 1884, was not within the purview of understanding of Congress in the adoption.
So let me ask you this. I think this is what you're basically saying, but doesn't this come down to whether we determine whether Congress still kept the mailbox rule in the statute or clearly, or whether it displaced it, right? If
yes,
it's ambiguous, then you lose because they have a notice and comment rulemaking that's probably entitled to Chevron deference.
Well, Your Honor, one of the issues...
I just want to set the grounds. I know you don't agree with this.
Your Honor.
This statute's ambiguous, then they have a notice and comment rulemaking that clarifies the mailbox rule doesn't apply. So if we agree with Chevron deference, then we would defer.
Your Honor, there are some, I think, factual predicates and issues with statutory and canonical understanding that come into play that would determine whether or not the statute is, in fact, ambiguous.
Can I just get one more try at you answering this basic question? If it's ambiguous, then we're going to defer to their notice and comment rulemaking.
If ambiguous, if truly, genuinely ambiguous, as Kaiser suggests, then you would move on to Chevron step two.
Okay, so what's the ambiguity? Is the ambiguity, how would you define the ambiguity? Looking at the face of the statute or whether or not the exceptions satisfy the standards about clearly evidence purpose? Is that how you get to the ambiguity?
Well, we would actually argue in several federal circuits, as well as the IRS agree, and I believe the court below as well, that as to the never delivered scenario that arises in this case, the statute is silent, and one of the issues is that silence and ambiguity under the Chevron analysis sort out somewhat differently. At step one, and this is the Kaiser caution of making sure there really is a genuine ambiguity, and I understand Kaiser is an our case, but when Justice Kagan was writing about and making the determination that occasionally courts move to a form of reflective deference, which stops them from doing the sort of searching and careful analysis required before deference applies, she said you must empty the toolkit. All the statutory tools must be applied. And that's the first step. What happens in the IRS's argument is they've collapsed Chevron steps one and two and essentially jumped to a reasonable interpretation of the statute. That's a little bit problematic because, as I stated, they also view the statute as silent. Once the silence is there, then the canons of statutory interpretation come in.
So is your argument seems to be suggesting that there's never deference. I mean, because by definition, if we're talking about the common law canon, it creates a presumption. It presumes that there is silence on that matter. So are you suggesting that in every case in which the common law canon is implicated, there's not going to be any Chevron deference because clearly the assumption, the predicate for that, is that there's no reference to the common law canon in the statute?
I wouldn't argue it that broadly, but I do believe that at Chevron step one, if the statute is silent, then the common law presumption canon steps in. And I believe, Your Honor, in your...
And what circumstance, therefore, under your rubric, would it not apply? Would we ever get to Chevron deference?
There may be common law rules that... And there's some circuit courts that have suggested common law rules that do not have the same sort of depth and history and well-settled nature that maybe the application is insufficient. And I think that could be a limiting principle. Here, the common law mailbox rule developed in the early, I believe, 1800s and was well-settled by 1884, 100
years. But before all this happened, there was a split in the circuits, and it was almost an even split. Doesn't that suggest some inherent ambiguity? I mean, in your mind, it's clear, but we had several U.S. courts of appeals going different ways on that question before the reg, right?
That's correct, but outcome differences doesn't necessarily establish that there's ambiguity in the statute. And I think that this is where the pre...
Well, I thought that those courts said there was ambiguity, not that the outcome was ambiguous. I was suggesting that it was a split on whether or not the statute was ambiguous or not.
As to the never delivered portion, the courts have come out that they're silent. And that's where the common law presumption then steps in. The way of looking at this is, as the Sixth Circuit said in Arangue...
Oh, but they're silent, but the courts have split on whether it's ambiguous as to whether Congress intended to maintain the mailbox rule or not, correct? Some went one way and some went the other way.
I don't believe they couched it in the language of ambiguity of congressional intent.
That's what we're talking about, though, right? We're talking about congressional intent because we're looking at whether the statute is plain on its face or not. And if enacting this, let me back up because I have a different question. The history of the statute is there was a split among circuits. Some said the IRS statute requires receipt. That's a hard line. Maybe they did that because there are specific situations to IRS and the amount of mail it gets and things like that. Some said we're going to incorporate the mailbox rule. So depending on which jurisdiction you lived in, you had a different statute of limitations applied. That's the scenario before 7520, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Congress steps in and says, we don't like this split. Here's the circumstances we're going to allow we're going to change the receipt required rule and be received by a certain date. And they have A, which says even if it's received after but postmarked before, it's okay. And then the other part is even if it's not received at all, we'll get it certified mail, registered mail receipt is good enough, right? That's an accurate description of what Congress did.
That is an accurate description.
But the question is then, did that intend to displace the mailbox rule or not, right?
Our answer is no.
Yes, but the question is, you have to show that it plainly did not intend to displace the mailbox rule, and all the government has to do to win is to show it's ambiguous as to what Congress intended to do, right?
I think as to Congress intent, they need to explicitly abrogate, which they did not do here. And Congress...
What do you mean they need to explicitly abrogate? Are you saying that in order to get rid of the mailbox rule, they have to say the mailbox rule does not apply?
I would say that would be one way for Congress to abrogate.
Can you cite me a case that says that?
I believe in, apologies, Your Honor. There is language in some of the cases that discuss the view that when looking at statutory intent of Congress, one, you have to consider the backdrop that's a wrong. Ongerary from the Sixth Circuit, you must consider the backdrop against which Congress was legislating.
Well, that's what I just asked you about. I mean, the backdrop here seems to be that there was a split about whether the mailbox rule intended to apply or not, and Congress didn't just say, yes, let's keep the mailbox rule going, which they could have. They could have codified the mailbox rule. Instead, they codified a different rule. So why doesn't that suggest they didn't intend to codify the mailbox rule?
I think that that goes back to the view that there is silence as to the current scenario, which is received.
I'm sorry. Just to clarify, I think in your dialogue with Judge Hughes, did you say that the only way to get rid of this is for Congress to have explicitly said, we are not applying the mailbox rule in any of these circumstances?
I don't think it needs to be that explicit, but the courts have been clear. If Congress is going to abrogate a common law rule, it needs to say something more. There needs to be legislative history suggesting
that. Well, some people don't really look to legislative history. So then we're left with the statute. So give me a couple of examples of what would have been sufficient here to abrogate the rule.
Well, I think first they would have had to address the instances where never delivered when placed into the United States
mail. So they have to say when never delivered, the rule doesn't apply, which is an explicit, as I was suggesting.
Yes.
Just trying to clarify, if you were saying in the absence of an explicit statement in the statute saying we're getting rid of the mailbox rule for the never apply, never delivered, then it carries the day.
Yes.
That's your... My understanding of the common law canon is that it's been termed a presumption. When you use the word presumption here, it suggests that you presume it, but you can dislodge it, not easily necessarily, but it's dislodgeable. So I'm trying to figure out how you would say it's dislodgeable. You're saying the only way you can get rid of it is by explicitly saying it doesn't apply. That doesn't compute right with
me. Well, the structure of the statute as well can indicate whether or not. So it doesn't have to be explicit. I think that the language in the cases discussing when the presumption may not apply is explicit, or there may be something implied about the structure of the statute. And again, because there's silence here as...
But give me an example of that. I guess I'm having a hard time. I thought you had said we need explicit language. So you're saying now we need something less than explicit language. So what? Give me an example of what you mean by the structure of the statute.
For example, I believe, if I understand the IRS's argument, the fact that there are, as Judge Hughes has pointed out, exceptions for certified and registered mail, which I believe the language in there is sent, that would then suggest abrogation of the common law rule. However, the general rule, with some specific rules delineated further, under the canons of statutory interpretation, does not raise that implication that's sufficient to override the common law presumption.
So if the statutory provision is inconsistent with the common law rule, that would be enough. Or it narrows the common law rule.
I would agree with Your Honor to an extent on that. I mean, and I think that it's not just simply... The structure could imply, but I think it needs to be something a little bit more, right? There, and that's where the canons of, you know, sort of statutory interpretation and common law presumption. I mean, if you have to step back a moment and consider...
Your time's about ready to run out, but I want to ask you this before you go away so that the IRS, if they want to talk about it, can. There isn't a lot of legislative history about this, but we looked... And there is at least one that explains in the context of the receipt, the 2 days with the mailing, that it concludes that only if it's actually received. Now, I know that's one stray statement out of one House report. We shouldn't give it much weight. But that's consistent with what that provision on provision A says, right? That you get the mailing date postmarked if it's actually received. And this says, but only if actually received. Doesn't that displace the mailbox rule?
It's not the taxpayer's view that that does displace the mailbox rule.
So your view is they enacted this statute to resolve a circuit split between whether the mailbox rule applied or not, and they said, we're going to allow a postmark to be evidence, but only if it's actually received. But they also implicitly meant, but
will actually allow the mailbox rule to apply even if it's not received.
Well, and I think a better, stepping back again, I think one of the things that Congress also did in that statute at that moment of adoption is they didn't actually limit the delivery methods by which refunds could be sent to the IRS, right? It's not only certified or registered mail. It's not only postal delivery. It's a modified postal
mail. I fail to understand why you don't see this as a comprehensive statute, because it said for stuff deposited in the postal service, we're going to loosen the receipt requirement and allow proof of postmark to show timely mailing if it's received. But if it's not received, here's this other provision. Why doesn't that address all the scenarios of U.S. mail and other forms and whether it's received or not?
Well, because I one of the issues with looking at the postmark shows proof of proper mailing, not necessarily receipt. And that's also what the mailbox rule suggests. It's about proof of proper mailing, and then it raises rebuttable presumption regarding delivery. And that was a rule that existed well before, as you mentioned, it sort of helped develop the circuit split. But I don't believe that the history is necessarily clear that Congress was specifically resolving the circuit split.
Has any circuit after IRS went through its notice and comment rulemaking, clarifying the mailbox ruling applied, said the doesn't apply, said the mailbox rule does apply?
I think that Baldwin is actually instructive on this.
Baldwin deferred to them. I'm just asking a very simple kind of question. Did I miss a case? But no other circuit has addressed this question post-regulation. Pre-regulation, there's splits. Post-regulation, we only have the Ninth Circuit, and they defer, right?
Well, I would like to clarify one point on the Baldwin decision. In the Baldwin decision, it specifically says that it did not overrule Anderson, which was the previous analysis under the mailbox rule saying that Congress did not abrogate the use of the common law. What Baldwin says is we have found ambiguity, and because of Chevron and Brand X deference, we must then defer to the statute. But that gets the analysis wrong. It's a collapsing of Chevron step one and two. And Baldwin was a pre-Kaiser case. It's clear on the face. I believe the Chevron analysis is maybe three paragraphs and is not the sort of careful analysis using the tools of statutory construction that Kaiser demands. I would suggest to the court, looking at Anderson, which is its predecessor, which was never explicitly overturned, that includes a much more searching analysis of the structure of the law, the legislative history, and the role that the common law plays. And as we mentioned, Baldwin never explicitly overturned Anderson. I think that that's somewhat of an important point. Taxpayers read Baldwin to say that the deference canon, Chevron and Brand X, coupled together, have tied their hands. That's also what the court below suggests, is there's not much room.
But what is the consequence of your saying that they didn't explicitly overturn Anderson? And therefore, what difference does that make?
Because at least for a persuasive point, Anderson still remains good law that the common law mailbox rule was not abrogated by the adoption of Section 7502. And that the way that Baldwin ultimately gets decided is a byproduct of deference regimes as opposed to statutory analysis. Again, Baldwin was pre-Kaiser, and that raises the issue of whether or not there was this careful use of all of the tools in the statutory construction toolkit.
Well, ask you one point about that, and I know you're over time and we'll restore your rebuttal, but just one final question since you raised the other tools. What are we to do, or do you have a case where you've got competing canons that you've got to apply? We don't know what order they're to be applied. This seems a very good example of expressio unius. I mean, they've got specific examples. They've got several examples. So at best for you, you've got competing canons. And we have to figure out what we do with that competition. Are there any cases that are relevant to this that deal with competing canons such as these?
I believe, Your Honor, in your concurrence and denial of rehearing in Bonk and Kaiser v. McDonough, you discussed about the concept of the hierarchy of canons, and I can't believe it was your language or Judge Reyna's language regarding the order of operations. in looking at that, first, we need to look at the descriptive canons. And I believe both the negative implication canon and the common law presumption would be deemed descriptive canons. I think in terms of the order of operation, as Your Honor has suggested, I would argue, and the taxpayers argue, that the common law presumption at Chevron step one has primacy over the negative implication canon. And as suggested in our replies, the negative implication canon doesn't necessarily shake out the way IRS argues, as both in the IRS's papers and Baldwin, because the negative implication canon was argued there, that was argued at step two. IRS uses the negative implication canon to say that its analysis is reasonable. We say it's step one. The common law presumption would fill in any silence in order to determine whether or not the court can move on to step two. We say that, as the court in Epic Systems suggested, once the statutory canons fill it, Chevron leaves the stage. And we believe that that's true here. The common law presumption carries the day in filling the statutory silence, if any, and the other canons simply fall away, and certainly Chevron step two does.
Is there any problem here? Are we headed down a slippery slope by allowing or affirming the abrogation of a common law doctrine by agency regulation?
Your Honor, I believe that is a relatively dangerous slope to go down. And there's cases where the common law presumption, I believe in Arange, which is the Sixth Circuit decision, applied res judicata, which is a very important common law rule. And if the court is searching for where the line is, there are well-settled common law principles, the sort of black-letter law that exists, and that might be a line worth drawing. But I do agree that by saying that that the agency at any point in time can abrogate an existing common law rule, it goes against the concepts of notice, fairness.
Well, that's only if Congress intended plainly to keep the common law rule, right? I mean, that's a dangerous scenario. If Congress intended common law rules to be applied and the agencies nevertheless jettison them, that's probably has a whole host of legal problems. But if it's ambiguous as to whether Congress intended it to apply, then we would apply our normal rules of Chevron, right?
Well, yes, if it is genuinely ambiguous. But again, congressional intent and the structure of the statute and the common law presumptions, as Judge Prost has indicated, that those are all canons that both compete and inform each other, and you only get to genuine ambiguity in congressional intent after all those analyses are done. And that sort of careful searching analysis is what we're asking the court to do regarding the common law presumption that the mailbox rule continues to play a role.
Okay. Not your fault, our fault, but we've gone way over our time. We'll reserve your rebuttal and let's hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Johnshoy and I represent the United States. This is the second appeal in this case.
Can I just ask you a preliminary sort of housekeeping thing? And this
yes.
is in response, I think Judge Hughes asked your friend. The rule went into effect in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Is this issue alive in any other circuits other than in the Ninth Circuit where we know about Baldwin?
I think the issue has come up in the Eighth Circuit and in the Third Circuit, but not to the circuit court, just to the district courts. The issue would be alive in any circuit that had previously allowed the common law mailbox rule to apply.
So the Ninth is the only one that's expressly ruled on your regulation?
Yes. Yes, the only other statement I'm aware of from a circuit court is this court's statement in Ananya versus McDonough.
And what about those Eighth and so there are cases pending in district courts. Do you know if any district courts have decided this issue? You mentioned the Eighth, I think, and the Third.
Yes. There was a case we brought up in a 28-J letter called Crispino, It was recent out of New Jersey. And I can't remember the name of the case out of the District of Minnesota, but I believe it's cited in Crispina.
And what way do they go?
They follow the regulation, and they uphold the regulation under Chevron.
So in follow-up to my question to your friend, is this a case, am I reading this right, this is a case of the abrogation of a common law doctrine by agency regulation?
No, I don't believe so. That's certainly how it's being construed, but we view it differently. So we think that Congress meant to clarify the rule in the statute.
The issue today is teed up, or we're reviewing the interpretation of an agency regulation, correct?
Yes.
And we're looking at that agency regulation to see if, in fact, it abrogates the common law doctrine or not.
Yes. But you could also find that the statute itself was unambiguous and that the statute does not allow the common law mailbox rule where 7502 applied.
Well, it's unambiguous because it's silent. And the agency has filled in that silence with the regulation. It's filled in a gap.
Yes.
And that regulation abrogates a common law doctrine.
We're not sure the common law doctrine ever actually applied in tax cases. Some circuits had allowed it just before.
I gotta tell you, I have a real problem with the silence issue that you brief, and it's only, lucky for you perhaps, it's only part of your argument.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it always the case that when we're talking about the common law canon, there's going to be silence? It's precisely because the statute doesn't say anything that we have this common law application that we presume applies. So now you're saying silence means the canon doesn't apply. And I always would have interpreted silence to mean that the canon applies.
But
it's just an odd argument to me.
The canon could apply, but there are other canons, like expressio unius. And so I'm not sure that it would be fair to just jump to the one canon versus the others.
Well,
so I'm confused too. I thought the argument was this statute was either expressly displaced the mailbox rule in your view,
mm-hmm.
or was it at least ambiguous as to whether it displaced the mailbox rule. Not that it was just silent.
Well, when we say it's ambiguous, we were also saying that it was silent.
I don't know.
Right, but it's two different things, right? If this was a statute
mm-hmm.
and it didn't address it at all, and it was silent, usually agencies get gap-filling authority over silence, but if it's a common law presumption, you presume that Congress intended to incorporate that, so it's really not silence. So I don't understand why you're relying so much on silence. I thought the argument you made and the way you looked at this in a better way was the adoption of this statute was to respond to a question about whether the mailbox rule applied. It didn't adopt it. Mm-hmm. It laid out conditions for when delivery would qualify, when receipt would qualify, when you didn't need receipt. And so in that sense, it displaced it, either plainly or at least ambiguously replaced it.
Yes.
Well, why are you talking about silence? That doesn't sound like silence to me. That sounds like the argument is the statute explicitly dislodged the mailbox rule, or at least ambiguously dislodged the mailbox rule.
I think perhaps our argument has conflated then the ambiguity with the silence, and silence being that they did not sort of explicitly state, and the mailbox rule is hereby, not going to apply.
They don't say anything at all. It's not just they don't explicitly state it. There's no statement at all as to the application of the common law doctrine.
That's right. We think it's literally silent, but it's also ambiguous because it does apply multiple ways in which you can show prima facie evidence of filing where, in fact, the filing was never delivered.
Your view is that Congress doesn't have to explicitly state the mailbox rule doesn't apply to dislodge the mailbox rule.
Correct.
It has to somehow evidence its intent to dislodge the mailbox rule either by an explicit statement or by enacting a scheme that is somewhat less than the mailbox rule or is inconsistent with the mailbox rule.
Correct. I would agree.
The amendments to the regulation all deal with when the letter is received, correct? The postmark on the registered mail, the certified mail, those amendments all pertain to whether something was received or not.
I'm not sure I follow. I think those are providing for cases where nothing was in fact received, and then holding that the postmark date or the registered mail date would be accepted as the filing date.
As the date of receipt.
Yes.
The common law doctrine that we're exploring here today goes to whether a mailing was ever actually made, not received.
No, I don't think that's right. The actual background is the physical delivery rule. So even under the common law mailbox rule, you know, the item still needs to have been delivered. That is, you know, filing occurs when the item is delivered to the
Correct.
Proper office.
And the common law doctrine says that if there's evidence that a person, individual, deposited the form or whatever in the U.S. mail, then this satisfied the regulation. This is prior, before it was amended.
There would be an argument.
So that physical delivery is different from the amendments that went to the receipt of a mailing, right? Or am I getting this wrong?
I don't think they're just sort of divorced and separate. The general requirement, the actual requirement for filing is still delivery, but it now holds that these other things will qualify. It creates some exceptions where there weren't exceptions before.
Prior to the enactment of the statute, the government's position was receipt was required in all instances, right?
Yes.
And there was a circuit split, and some circuits allowed the mailbox rule to prove receipt, some didn't.
Yes.
And Congress stepped in and said, I'm not going to put words in the Congress mouth, but the statute prescribes different ways for something that can be considered timely filed and received, which includes some instances where it's received, but received late with the postmark before, and some instances where it's not received at all, mm-hmm. which is what the mailbox rule usually covers, right?
Yes.
The mailbox rule covers when something, they can show it was timely mailed, but it was never received. And yes. Congress spoke to the circumstances where it was never received, but they could show timely mailing, but they didn't go whole in mailbox rule. They said you have to give us registered mail receipt.
That's right, and over time they added to that. So it started with just registered mail receipt, then they added a provision to allow for certified mail, and eventually for private delivery, certain FedEx
At
services.
At that time, why didn't Congress just go ahead and say we're not going to have the common law doctrine anymore?
That would have been too easy.
I do think that would have simplified the matter, but perhaps they already thought they had done it.
Don't we assume that Congress was aware that the common law doctrine existed?
We could assume that, but what would be the point of adding certified mailing if the taxpayer already could have proved it with their own testimony? You know, the whole point of a certified mailing receipt is to have some direct evidence of mailing. So I think that's contrary to the sort of...
But you don't have to prevail on whether Congress explicitly intended to overrule this, right? You just have to show that it is ambiguous as to whether Congress intended to displace the mailing rule.
That's right.
Is that really right? I thought the case law, it was clear that to dislodge the common law canon, that the canon applies unless there's, quote, a clear statement or an evident statutory purpose to the contrary.
I'm not sure the canon ever actually applied, though, and certainly not in this circuit. Some circuits had adopted it, and then the statute came in, and then there's now been debate amongst the circuits as to the meaning of that. But it's not clear the common law mailbox rule ever applied for the context of tax filings. Certainly, if the statute's ambiguous, though, then there'd be deference under the regulation. Having talked about filing for a while, I'd like to move on and just make a point that we actually think the simplest and most straightforward way to decide this case is timeliness, not actually filing. And one reason the court lacked jurisdiction is more than enough. So, for instance, in this court's prior remand, this court found that the taxpayers had only raised a claim for business bad debt and remanded to the CFC for jurisdictional findings. After a trial, the CFC found that there was no debt. And even if there was a debt, the loss was not business related. It related only to their status as a shareholder. So there could be no business bad debt that'd be necessary for timeliness.
So is this the 3 versus the 6 year statute of limitations?
Three versus seven. And there's two versions of the seven. One is for the direct year of the loss, and one is for a carryback theory.
So, and the carryback theory was that argued below?
By implication, it was.
Okay, so you're not arguing a waiver then?
Well, we are arguing a waiver as to non-business debt and loss for worthless stock. Those were never raised before.
Okay.
But as to business bad debt, the implication was for a carryback because no one believed that the loss had occurred in 2003. The company only first
I was confusing those latter two theories with just the carryback. But there's two different ways of arguing the carryback. One is they did it in 2004 to carry back as just business debt. And then the other two theories were in 2004, this qualified under these other two problems. Those are new, right?
Yes, those are wholly new.
So I struggle with this because I'm not a tax expert by any means, but what's the difference between, it seems to get referred to as business debt versus capital.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the statute that defines bad business debt, and why isn't, you know, paying income on, or paying taxes on income you never received from a business you own a share in, not bad business debt?
Right. Well, the statute would be 166, and this court's case law has fleshed out sort of numerous factors to be considered to decide whether something is capital or debt. You know, for instance, does it have a payment schedule? Is interest going to be required? The sort of hallmarks of debt. And the CFC found that none of those, you know, were present in this case. Beyond that, then, you have to classify the debt as either business or non-business, whether it relates to your trade or business or whether it relates solely to your status as a shareholder, that is, as an investment. And this, you know, this, Muhammad Taha never worked in the corporation, so this only, related to his status as an investor.
Wouldn't one of your alternative theories require a remand?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. No. And I say that because, you know, taxpayers argue in their briefing that the year of the loss on their theories is 2004, and they cannot carry back a loss to 2004 under any of their new alternative theories. So a non-business debt is treated as a capital loss. That cannot be carried back. Similarly, a loss on worthless stock would be a capital loss. That cannot be carried back. So it's impossible. And not only is it impossible, to get the 7-year time limit, to get the 7-year extended time limit, the loss has to result in a carryback. So there's sort of an overlap between the jurisdictional and the merits. So we also as to these two new theories, non-business debt and worthless stock, we note that neither of these theories were contained in a claim for refund. So they would both violate the substantial variance doctrine. And I think on this point, taxpayers really need to take the bitter with the sweet. If, in fact, they filed a 2-page amended tax return that'll serve as a claim for refund, that claim for refund has to contain all of their legal theories. They cannot now raise a legal theory that is not in that claim for refund. In addition, they never raised it during the litigation, prior to the first appeal or even at the trial after. Not until this appeal were these new theories asserted.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I was going to restore just 2 minutes, but we'll give you a little more time because the questions about the merits issues just came up and you didn't have a chance to respond at all. So we'll give you 3 or 4 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. And before jumping to our response to some of the merits issues, I believe earlier Chief Judge Yu had asked about what's effectively the hierarchy of canons. And if we're looking at competing canons, I believe Judge Nelson wrote in our Aranguere, it's hard to imagine an interpretive tool more traditional than centuries-old common law presumption. And I think that when we're looking at the hierarchy or the order of operations in which competing canons may be applied, the common law presumption should get some form of primacy or at least be moved up in the list amongst the competing canons. The other question that I believe came up to the IRS was that, you know, whether or not, how do we dislodge the common law canon? We had mentioned earlier that, you know, there needs to be some sort of clear impulse or indication from Congress that they intended to, and I think the language in Philadelphia Marine from the Third Circuit is instructive on this point. It says, it's well-established principle of statutory construction, the common law ought not to be deemed repealed unless the language of a statute be clear and explicit for this purpose. Interestingly, in that case, the Third Circuit also goes on.
This doesn't answer the questions we were having before. We have this general language, but what does Congress have to do to dislodge the mailbox rule? Are you taking the position that to not apply the mailbox rule, they have to say the mailbox rule doesn't apply?
I wouldn't say it's that level of absolutism, because I do think that you can, again, look at the structure of the statute, you look at congressional intent. And one of the things that the Third Circuit opines on is what would be the underlying rationale.
So let me ask you this hypothetical then. If Congress, there is no statute that addresses the mailbox rule one way or another, and so it's presumed to apply, courts for years have been applying it, and then they enact a statute that has various provisions going through for this type of claim, it should be considered timely delivered or filed within the statute of limitations if it's mailed before the date but received after and the postmark shows it was mailed before. Or, in the next section, you'll see that this is very close to the statute, but I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of this. If it's never received, it shall be considered timely delivered only in these circumstances.
I think that cuts a little bit closer
so if,
to this sort of language
required. If the registered
required.
Mail had the word only instead of just here's when, if we never receive it, we'll consider it timely filed.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that goes to sort of the idea of whether or not it was displaced. I would say a phrase including only these methods would potentially create a displacement of that. I think that's language that would be deemed explicit enough in order to do that. That's not the case with the statute here. And, you know, as I was going to say, in Philadelphia Marine, the Third Circuit also opined that at least as a matter of logic.
What's the name of this is the Third Circuit?
Yes.
What's the name of that case?
Philadelphia Marine Trade Association. It's a long one, Your Honor. Philadelphia Marine Trade Association, International Longshoremen's Association Pension Fund versus the Commissioner of Internal Revenue.
Where are you reading from in that case?
I'm reading from page 150. And the court says, moreover, as a matter of logic, it is difficult to imagine that Congress, by passing a law that was designed to protect taxpayers who meet 7502's requirements, would, without so stating, simultaneously seek to roll back protections for taxpayers that already exist at common law. Congress's intent, we believe, was to supplement, not supplant, means by which taxpayers can timely file documents with the IRS, and that's relying on a state of wood, which is the Eighth Circuit case.
So this is essentially a policy argument, right? This is, well, if Congress is trying to clarify something, we're going to assume they didn't mean to take away rights from the taxpayers because the mailbox rule in some circuits applied and some didn't. But don't you have in the IRS context a completely different set of policy reasons? I mean, the IRS must get millions and millions of pieces of mail. And why wouldn't we read this as setting clear objective requirements for when you can show timely delivery even without actual receipt, which is you have documentary proof? Your view is going to allow cases to be filed in a lot of cases where the only proof is going to have to be a court-tested view of somebody's testimony. And isn't that inconsistent with the way the IRS operates, which has very strict deadlines on a number of things? It has a lot of rules. Even the Supreme Court has recognized that general equitable principles about tolling and the like generally don't apply to the IRS. So why shouldn't we read the policy enacting 7502 in that sense, that it wanted to to loosen up the receipt-only rule, but it didn't want to go all the way.
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that bureaucratic inconvenience isn't necessarily a reason for displacing centuries-old common law. And I think that that's probably an after-the-fact rationale that the IRS has developed, that it's too hard, it's too unworkable to have this common law
presumption. Sure, but you're starting from the presumption that the common law mailbox rule applied to this. And Congress didn't start from that presumption. They started from a world where some circuits strictly applied the delivery rule with no exception, and some circuits allowed the mailbox rule. And so when they're enacting the statute, we have to look at it in that context. Even you agree that when we're looking to dislodge, whether the Congress intended to dislodge the mailbox rule, you look at the circumstances. So you want us to look at this as Congress is operating against the backdrop of the mailbox rule, but some circuits, a fair amount of them, had said it doesn't apply. So you could see this as a liberalizing statutory change that didn't go all the way to the full-blown mailbox rule, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, the sort of rationale that's proposed in Kaiser regarding the depth of consideration for statutory canons and review should be looked at in the context of those circuits and how they decided the mailbox rule question post-enactment of 7502. If you look at cases like...
I'm not sure how it matters. Oh, you mean post-7502.
Post-7502.
What, aren't we looking at what Congress did in 7502?
It's one of the considerations, but the courts in Anderson and Philadelphia Marine and Estate of
isn't
Wood...
Isn't it the entire consideration? Because what we're looking at in this case is whether Congress intended to allow the mailbox rule to continue to go forward or not allow it. And the landscape it was operating on was some circuits said, yes, mailbox rule. Some circuits said, no, no exceptions, delivery only.
And I do believe that that's some of the framework, but I also agree.
Whether those circuits that said no mailbox rule were right or not, they were in existence, so Congress was legislating against that backdrop. And they knew about the mailbox rule, so if they're trying to resolve a circuit split and they want to incorporate the mailbox rule, why wouldn't they have codified the mailbox rule instead of the alternate version of receipt and delivery rules that they did?
Well, I think that premise may be somewhat inverted, is that if Congress is legislating against the backdrop of the common law rule, it's effectively already considered in what they're doing. And so that our
yes, but again, that's my point is you're proceeding from the presumption that the common law mailbox rule was well accepted in this area, and it wasn't. It was disputed. And when Congress enacts against a disputed common law rule, you don't necessarily intend show it doesn't necessarily show that they intended to incorporate it when it's a disputed applicability. I mean, that's a presumption too.
I would agree with Your Honor on that, but I would also suggest that one of the issues that might be arising with the application of the common law mailbox rule is that we're talking about slightly different versions of the mailbox rule. Taxpayers are talking about common law mailbox rule writ large, the one that's been well settled since the 1884 per the Supreme Court. What the IRS has argued is something a little bit more nuanced, an IRS-specific common law mailbox rule. And that might be creating some of the wrinkles that Your Honor is identifying in looking at the statutory interpretation question. But we're saying that the common law mailbox rule as a whole, in the traditional sense that it applies across all of the government, it has primacy. That circuits may have adopted, I believe, as my colleagues mentioned in their papers, may have raised a common law mailbox rule as the IRS. I think that that's somewhat incorrect. The mailbox rule exists. It may have been applied in IRS circumstances, but that doesn't necessarily defeat the fact that Congress did not clearly and explicitly, dislodge the common law mailbox rule from practice. And I wanted to just...
Yeah, can you move on? Just I really do want to give you a couple minutes.
And I think so. As the timeliness question, and my colleague indicated as much, and I think it's one of the issues that gets a little bit confusing, is there is a combining of jurisdictional questions and merits questions. We're here in the posture of a jurisdictional challenge. Mr. Taha alleged that there was a debt that was incurred at some point that would trigger the 7-year statute of limitations. The court below had determined that it was capital, that may or may not be subject to 7-year statute of limitations as well, and then went on to the merits analysis. And the real question here is whether or not there was a timely filing under 6511, and it's our view that that is true. And the IRS admits as much that for business...
I don't understand what you're saying. Are you saying that it was improper on the 12B1 to determine whether this money we're talking about, the facts of which appear to be undisputed, was business debt or capital?
Yes, Your Honor. And part of that goes
why?
To...
Why? I mean, you can make jurisdictional factual determinations if it goes to the statute of limitations, can't you?
Well, first, one of the issues is that...
Let me ask you this. Are there any facts in dispute about what occurred here with regards to this, what the character of this money is?
I think that there are. I mean, and Mr. Todd...
What are they?
For example...
Not the ultimate question of whether it's business debt or not. What is the dispute of fact?
I believe the dispute of fact was whether or not it was timely filed.
And no. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, it seems like he had a share in this business. He was expected to get a certain payout, and he didn't. He reported that payout on his income taxes and paid taxes on it, and he didn't get the payout. Is there any dispute as to all of that?
As to the underlying facts, no. As to the combination of where facts...
No. Okay, so stop. So is there any dispute about whether that money he was receiving was income or something else?
Yes.
And what was it then, in your view?
He argues that it's a debt, and as the record shows, there was a promissory note issued by ADAC Corporation to him, and we talk a little bit about...
And so your view, this money that he was being paid was a loan repayment?
Well, he was never paid the money subject to the promissory note. And so that's why...
Let me try again. I'm sorry if I'm not being precise. Your argument is this money that he said he was going to get and didn't get and reported taxes on nevertheless was a repayment of that promissory note.
No, that would have been repayment of the shares. Then the promissory note fills in. That's what the debt analysis is based on, that there was a promissory note which created a loan.
Is this the argument that was not raised below?
No, I believe it was raised below. All the documents regarding the promissory note are in the record. And
you know what I'm talking about, right? Your friend got up and said there's some arguments that you raised below, and then there's these two other theories that weren't explicitly raised below. Are we talking about the one that wasn't raised below?
No, we're talking about one that was raised below. The promissory note from that's applicable to the 2003 tax refund is in the record and was considered by the court. I believe it was also admitted in trial, but attached to some of the
later briefing. Let me just try to get the facts straight one more time, though, because I don't follow what you're saying. Was the money he was supposed to get paid in 2003 and never got paid, but he paid taxes on, was that a payment under the promissory note, or was that something else?
At the time that the initial 2003 filing was made, it was income from his shares in ADAC Corporation.
Okay, stop. So at that time, he considered it income from his shares. And when he reported on his taxing returns, he paid taxes on it as income.
That's correct.
Would that be bad business debt?
No, the bad business debt question arises because of the promissory note.
So you're recharacterizing what he paid income tax on now as something that was covered as bad business debt under the promissory note.
I believe, Your Honor, that we need to look at both the initial 2003 filing and the amended 1040 in combination. And it's the amended 1040, my understanding, that's sort of the subject of the challenge. And that's where he then attempts to take the losses as a result of the promissory note, because those shares were never, that money was never paid out.
But that doesn't correspond to the 2003 payment that he didn't receive. That corresponds to something else.
I believe it directly does, because that money was never paid out. He had to pay based on his shareholdings, but that money never came into play and was subject to a promissory note that was never acted upon. I believe there was something along the lines of $20,000 that was eventually transferred to him subject to the agreements. But what we're saying is that the promissory note needs to be considered, and that comes under the Sunex factors. The promissory note on its face looks like a loan document, looks like a document that suggests indebtedness.
I'm still not following, though. If the promissory note had required a payment in a certain tax year and he didn't get that payment, he could deduct that as bad business debt, right?
I believe so. Okay. The promissory note...
The promissory note is not what led to the payment that he didn't get that he paid taxes on, though.
Well, the loss of the business itself made the promissory note worthless. There was, as the bankruptcy proceedings, and it's in the record below, there was no money left to pay despite him making a claim against the bankruptcy estate as a creditor.
Okay.
And if there's no further questions, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you. We thank both sides in the cases.